Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for dialing into the April 2017 monthly conference call by the Harbor Group of RBC Dominion Securities. This month's call is titled, Fundamentals Continue to Defy the Political Sideshow, and I'm joined by my colleague and our lead strategist, Robin Gullison. Welcome, Robin.
Thanks, Chris.
To start the call off, Robin, can you please give us a high-level overview of the document that you just published, which for our listeners has also been posted to our website. The summary page you've titled that we continue to believe that equities will outperform. Can you give us a couple of reasons why you think this is the case?
Certainly. I'll just go through the different asset classes by what we think the return potential is. And if you start off at the most basic, cash, we still have a Bank of Canada who today decided to leave interest rates on hold, unlikely to hike interest rates until sometime next year. So we don't see cash returns going much higher than they are now, which is kind of in the 1% range plus or minus. So that's a pretty low hurdle. If you look at the fixed income market, you've had yields start to increase globally as the U.S. Fed has increased interest rates and central banks around the world have backed off from their extraordinary monetary policy. So again, looking at the current yield on a typical fixed income portfolio in Canada, probably under 2%. I think it would take quite a bit to earn significantly more than that on return. We look at the dividend yield as a starting point for a reasonable equity portfolio. That's, 3% is not that hard to achieve. And you tack on any sort of growth and you kind of go from there. So if you've got an equity return that can approach the high single digits versus cash at around 1 and fixed income at 2 to 3, we think the potential is much greater in equity than it is in those other asset classes.
And Robin, being a little bit specific, what are the what sort of targets do we have on the U.S. market and the Canadian market, over the course of the next 12 months?
So our U.S. strategist target for the U.S. market is up around 10% for the year. Right now, you're up around 3% for the S&P 500, so still pretty reasonable gains. Our Canadian strategist thinks the TSX can get to those kind of total return levels over about an 18-month time period. So still pretty healthy returns according to their forecasts over the next year or two.
And is that inclusive or exclusive of dividends, Robin?
That is price only return that they're looking at in their forecasts.
So dividend yield would be another approximately 2% for the U.S. market and 3% for the Canadian market.
Roughly, yes.
And what would be the biggest risks to this call? In the last several weeks, we've had slightly weak equity markets that have been trading sideways to slightly down on a day-to-day basis, a little bit of a different tone than we had in the first couple of months of the year. What are the big risks that we see to this call of equities outperforming?
Well, the big risk is always to be the risk that you get a U.S. recession. That is the number one thing that can happen that would be detrimental to the equity market, because when you get a U.S. recession, you tend to get two things happen. You tend to get profits going down materially, and you tend to get valuations coming in. You add those together, that's how you get a pretty bad return during recessions. The way we look at the world, we look all over the place for probabilities of recession happening in the U.S., and from what we see, it's nothing really on the horizon right now that points to an imminent recession in the U.S. So that's the first thing that could cause a truly unpleasant outcome. In order to get a correction, which, again, tends to happen every year, you get a 5% to 10% correction. And to get that to happen, you could have any number of things. You could have interest rates shoot up a little bit too quickly that might spook the equity market, and if that's accompanied by stronger growth, I think that resolves itself fairly quickly. You could have some sort of political or geopolitical crisis, and again, we've been struck by a few of those over the last 5-6 years, and our focus has always been on the economy and the long term, and as long as the long term outlook hasn't changed, those have proven to be buying opportunities, and that's the tack we would take again if that were to happen this year.
Great. Robin, on page number 3 of your presentation, you have a slide that's entitled Global Manufacturing Has Turned Up Sharply. Why did you include this? What's important here that we should be looking at?
So one of the better forward-looking indicators we have is the global PMI surveys, the Purchasing Managers Indexes, and these are proxies for global manufacturing growth, and these tend to be a leading indicator for the economy. And you can see here on page 3, if you have the presentation in front of you, this chart shows that the number of Purchasing Managers Indexes around the world that are in expansionary territory, so over 52, and these are indexes that range from 0 to 100. And typically when you're over 52, you consider that to be manufacturing expanding. You can see that's now the highest it's been since 2011. So we're actually seeing synchronized global growth for the first time in a number of years. This includes places like Europe that have been a bit of a challenge, and of course there's still political challenges going on there, but as far as the economy goes and what actually drives earnings, that's been improving.
You know, we'll stick with the word recession, but this time use it on a positive tone. It looks like on page five, you've called the end to the earnings recession in the U.S. Can you explain what you think is taking place here?
Yeah, so in the chart on page five, there's kind of a boxed in area, and it says mid-cycle earnings recession, and that was due to the energy crash. So you had a period of time there where oil went from $100 to $20. It had a very, very nasty effect on the energy industry and also a lot of industries that supply energy. And at the end of that cycle, you even had people worrying about the banks and the credit risks they had. So it kind of was almost all-encompassing about a year ago. In the early 2016, we'll all remember what that felt like. And, of course, that's resolved itself fairly positively. And now you have the forward earnings expectation for the U.S. market at a new all-time high and reaching a new all-time high every day. So that tells us that analysts are continuing to mark up their earnings expectations for the U.S. market.
And is this data predominantly U.S. or is it Canada?
This particular chart is U.S., but you see a similar trend in Canada. It'd be a little more volatile because the energy is a much larger part of our index than it is in the U.S.
So it would be fairly typical in this sort of dialogue that, you know, you've made the argument that U.S. market's going to do well and Canada will follow suit, although on a delayed basis. And we've talked a little bit about volatility and we've talked a little bit about earnings recovering. You know, the next natural question is, what about valuation? Robin, can you talk to us about valuation in the Canadian market and perhaps the U.S. market while we're at it?
Sure. So, you know, valuation in Canada, I think, has more to do with the meets the eye. So if you look at it on a broad index basis, which includes all the sectors, it would be a little bit above average. You know, that includes things like energy and materials that are very volatile and have earnings that go all over the place. And therefore, these stocks may trade at very low or very high PEs at different points in the cycle from the rest of the market. So we've got an interesting data set on page six from RBC Capital Markets. This shows the forward price earnings ratio of the TSX if you take out the resources sector. So you take out energies, take out materials, gold, all those sorts of things. And it shows you that you have the rest of the market trading a PE that's not that far off the average. And this average goes back to 1979. So it includes some extremely low PE ratios seen in the early 1980s when interest rates were double digits. So we think that the valuation in Canada outside of the resources sector isn't that challenging at all. And even in the resources sector where you might have some higher PE ratios, that's because you have depressed earnings due to the oil crash and all the volatility we've seen in energy prices.
And what about the U.S.? You know, they oftentimes say that Canada data follows that of the U.S. And, you know, I know you don't have a slide in your chart book here, but can you talk about valuation in the U.S.? And is valuation a catalyst for change?
So the valuations in the U.S. are definitely higher than in Canada, and that's for a number of reasons. Number one is you have more companies there that are leveraged towards economic growth, and those kind of companies have seen their price-earnings ratios increase as we've had growth expectations increase. And to your point about timing, you know, we've learned over the long term that valuation is definitely something to be cognizant of, but it is by no means a timing mechanism unless you're at the extremes. And as an example of this, we had a chart in, I believe, last month's presentation that showed kind of a mix of different valuation metrics all averaged out into one chart. And if you look at this chart, it would show that, yes, valuations in the U.S. are higher than average right now. It would also show on this chart that valuations were higher than average from 1990 to 2008. So for an 18-year period, you could have called the U.S. stock market expensive. And over that period, it compounded at something around 7% annually. So that is kind of proof right there in the data that the valuation is by no means a timing mechanism. At the extremes, maybe it becomes a little more pertinent, but over the long term, if you said I wasn't going to buy the market because it's expensive, you wouldn't be in the market for a long period of time because valuation tends to go in very long-term trends.
Terrific. You've included a kind of complicated chart on page number seven of your presentation that says the yield curve is in the sweet spot for returns. And for our listeners, can you first of all tell us what a yield curve is in case that they don't work in the financial industry, and then decipher this page for us and tell us what point you're trying to get across by presenting it?
I apologize in advance, everybody. I'm a former fixed income person. Sometimes I just can't help myself, but it would include a fixed income type chart, and this is one of them. The yield curve is a fancy way to say the difference between a 10-year bond yield and a 3-month T-bill yield. They call that differential the yield curve because if you plot out all the maturities of the bond market from 3 months to 2 years to 5 years to 10, et cetera, you end up with a curve. So this simply shows the difference between 10-year yields and 3-month yields. The most important thing about looking at this chart is when it goes negative. So when you get a 3-month yield that is above a 10-year yield, typically a recession follows within a couple of years. Not instantly, but typically within a couple of years. And that has been borne out in the return data. So this breaks down return data for the U.S. market, S&P 500, by different yield curve spreads. So if you look at the very bottom when the yield curve is inverted, no surprise, as I told you, that typically happens around recessions, you get an average return of negative 0.9%. Same thing at 0 to 50 basis points, quite low returns, 0.9%, plus 0.9%, because again, you're typically coming into or going out of recession when the yield curve is very low. Gets a little more interesting when you have a yield curve of 50 to 100 basis points, or half to 1%. Right now, we're at about 157 basis points, or 1.57%. That tends to be when you have the highest returns. We've seen 100 and 200 basis points. You've averaged over a long term 14.5% returns when you have that yield curve spread in that range. And if you have a yield curve over 200 basis points, so very steep, that tends to be when you're coming out of recessions, because central banks have cut rates very sharply and long-term rates haven't come down as much. Then you have returns averaging almost 9%. So this tells us that when you have the yield curve at this reading at about 1.5%, it tends to be when you're well into an economic recovery, you still have growth ahead of you, and historically it's generated very strong returns. Now, I'd love to forecast 14.5% returns. I'm not going to do that here, but it is saying that you are in a pretty good place as far as historical returns go with the yield curve right now.
Okay. Makes perfect sense. You've got a really interesting chart on slide number 8 that's titled The Many Reasons to Sell That Were Actually Great Buy Points. And, you know, from personal experience, I can, you know, see a number of events here that caused, you know, our phones to light up with clients calling concerned about whatever the crisis of the day was. Can you tell us your interpretation of this slide that you've got here on page number 8, and how should we be interpreting it?
Yeah, sure. I saw this come across my inbox a couple of weeks ago and thought I just have to include it in one of these presentations and show people, because it is so interesting. And it shows you that typically when concern about some event, be it political or otherwise, is the only thing you hear about in the media, it's probably mostly priced into the market and almost over and ends up being a buying opportunity. Now, of course, the exception would be if we were heading into a recession, but since 2009, we haven't had a recession. We've had a lot of volatility in the market and a lot of things that have scared people. And the lesson here is that if you let fear take over and act on emotions, it costs you a lot of money in the long term. So you look at all these different things on here, and these were all things that were, you know, giant headlines in the cover of the Globe and Mail and all you saw on financial television. And we've actually got a way on one of our systems to graph out the prevalence of different news stories, and we can graph those against the market. And again, when you see a certain subject go parabolic and be the number one red story on the Bloomberg machine, for example, it typically means it's pretty much priced in and it's a little safer to wade back into the waters. So this again tells us that it's important to focus on the long term, focus on the fundamentals, because there's always noise. The media is in the business of selling news and selling panic almost, and no matter what the subject of the day is. So looking to them isn't going to help you make investment decisions. They're going to do their best to try and scare you. We try and look through that noise and keep a focus on the long term, and looking at the fundamentals has really helped us keep this out of our portfolios and keep us focused.
You know, speaking of you know, staying focused, you know, oftentimes, you know, you mentioned earlier on that it's kind of the rite of passage of owning equities that the market goes into some form of a corrective phase. And on page number 11, you say that there's two different types of corrections that can play out. One is time and one is price. Can you give us a little bit more details around that, please?
Sure. So the chart on page 11 shows the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the last 5 years. And I've boxed out what I would call a time correction, and then I've got some red arrows for the price corrections that we're all pretty familiar with. And what this simply shows is that you can have a market that corrects in price and goes down sharply by, you know, 5 to 10% and then kind of turns higher. But what we've seen in the last year in particular is that you've had a market that's had a sharp rally. It's lasted a few days, maybe a week. The market consolidates, so it goes nowhere for a while. It kind of goes up and down in a tight range. Then it pops up again for a few days and goes back to a range and is repeated that over and over again. And that's really challenging for somebody who's trying to time the market and trade it. Because when you only have a short period of time and the market's running up and the rest of the time it's going sideways, you kind of have to be there for those sideways parts to catch the up. Because if you wait for the first day up, by the time you get around to investing, it might be halfway over, and then you end up being frustrated. You missed a move. So this goes back to the conversations we've had many times about trying to time corrections. And the typical corrections you see in any given year are 5 to 7%, the average, or pardon me, 5 to 10%, the average is about 7. And they take a month to go down and 2 months to get back up. And we always say, you know, what's the chance we're going to sell at the top when the news looks good, sell at the bottom when it's a real challenge.
Buy at the bottom.
Pardon me, buy at the bottom. And give up the dividend income and pay potential capital gains tax. So that, to us, that doesn't seem like a very high probability outcome. We think those are much better used to buy on weakness and reposition our portfolios depending what's happened in the market. And this kind of gives a good example of, you know, some people get frustrated when the market hasn't gone anywhere for a while, but this shows us that patience is typically rewarded.
And on the preceding page, number 9, you had a chart here that said light cycle returns can be pretty powerful. And, you know, there's a fairly snappy chart at the bottom that shows, you know, average returns of 25%, which, you know, of course, all of our clients would love to participate in. Can you give us an idea of how do we get our hands on those sorts of returns?
Well, so this chart shows the returns in the final 12 months of a bull market. So from the peak of the bull market to the year before, the average return is 25%. You can see it ranges from about 10 to 40 in a couple of cases. And it actually provides about a fifth of the cycle's total return. So for the whole bull market's return, about 19% on average comes in the last year. And that tells us that, you know, everybody's worried about a bear market, and obviously that is something to worry about, but missing this, if you sell too early and you miss that last 25%, well, if the average bear market is 35%, it's not quite the same thing, but it's a pretty big return to miss out on. So this tells us that selling too early is something you want to avoid. And again, we keep on talking about focusing on the fundamentals in the long term, and this is why, because we don't want to get shaken out by these corrections or these news items that will cause us from missing the next leg up in the market.
And Robin, when you get into the late cycle, you know, for those listeners who don't sit in front of a computer screen all day long and have access to a Bloomberg, what kind of headlines are we going to read in the Globe and Mail and the media at large? You know, is it what we're reading today, or would it be something somewhat different?
Well, I think the big thing missing right now is euphoria on the part of individual investors and investors in general. It's much, much, much easier to find news stories about the impending crash, the impending recession, bear market, you know. The crisis of 2008 left some very deep scars, and it's allowed people who peddle in fear to do a phenomenal business, and they continue to do so to this day. And obviously those people will eventually be right, but if you listen to them for the last 8 years, you've missed a phenomenal return in the equity market. So I think when you get closer to the top, you're going to have the newspapers blaring about how great the equity market is, justifying getting in now, you know, leveraging up to invest, all these sorts of things that you typically don't see at the lows when they're telling you to sell. And I think you'll see the fear mongers will get a lot less airtime in the media. And they may still continue to get quite a bit of airtime in the media from what I see. So I think you have to see much more widespread optimism in the media before you start worrying about people being too overly optimistic.
Terrific. And just to give us an idea of a sense of time, the total economic growth of this expansionary phase, you know, what's it looked like relative to previous expansionary phases, and how much longer do we have to run in this bull market that we're currently in?
The unique thing about this cycle is that the average economic growth annually has been the lowest, one of the lowest of all time, and the cumulative growth is still relatively low as well. So even though it's been a long cycle, it hasn't been a very sharp cycle, I guess is the way to put it. Because of that, we haven't had a lot of excesses build up. So typically the way the cycle works is you have a recession, interest rates get cut, that boosts output in things like housing and automobiles. Eventually, you get to full employment, you get strong wage growth, you get inflation, central banks raise interest rates aggressively, and the whole cycle starts over again. Well, we're at the point now where, again, we're 8 years into this, and they've only raised interest rates 3 times in the U.S., and looking to do it maybe 2 more times this year. You think back to the 2004 to 2007 cycle, they were raising interest rates at every single meeting. So I think there's still a reasonable runway to go because we don't have any of those excesses that have really scared the central bankers to push too hard on the brakes, and that's typically what leads to recession. You get interest rates going too high. I mentioned that inverted yield curve before, so the short-term rate higher than the long-term rate. We call that having tight money. That stops the banks from lending, and that's typically what leads to a recession. And right now, again, going back to that yield curve chart, you're nowhere near there, and we don't really see any excesses in the market where the policymakers are worried about it and they're trying to snuff it out.
Robin, we've covered a lot of material today, and is there anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners to summarize your thoughts and conclude today's call?
Yeah, I guess in summary, I'd like to say again, as we said at the beginning, looking at the starting points for things like cash and fixed income, we still think equities have the best probability of providing a reasonable return to investors. It's a pretty low hurdle to cover off when you've got cash at around 1% and fixed income close to 2%. I think the economy itself hasn't been getting as much credit as it should because there's been so much noise about what's happening in Washington, D.C. The truth is that the economy has been doing better for the last year, and the election just happened to coincide with that. We think there are risks to yields going higher in the bond market. So, again, fixed income is going to be a return challenge going forward. And if yields do go higher, there are a lot of sectors of the equity market that can do quite well. So that's something we're looking to position ourselves for. And we've also seen a big divergence in sectors. So, again, there's opportunity to shift portfolios around to different sectors that are going to do well, depending on what the economy does. And last but not least, corrections are inevitable and unavoidable. But in our view, it's how we react to them that's going to determine the next phase of our returns.
Terrific. Well, Robin, thanks very much for joining us today. And to our listeners, thanks very much for dialing in. We appreciate your trust and confidence. And we will be back again a month from now for the May 2017 monthly update call. Have a great day.